This morning, I am planning to preach on the Beatitudes. Matthew 4 and verse 23 describes Jesus' ministry like this. Right at the end of chapter 4 of Matthew, it says, "He went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people." So Jesus' ministry consisted mainly of three different activities, if you notice them there. It says that he was teaching, that he was proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom, and he was healing. And if you look in the Gospel of Matthew, you see that that statement is made here in chapter 4 and verse 23. But if you were to turn to chapter 9 and verse 35, you would see almost the same statement, almost verbatim, word for word. And so in between 4:23 and 9:35, there are three chapters of Jesus' teaching and preaching. That's chapters 5 through 7. And then two chapters of Jesus' healings. That's chapters 8 and 9. And so that whole unit is framed by these descriptions of Jesus' ministry, that he was teaching, preaching, and healing. And chapters 5 through 7 is the teaching and preaching section. And so when Jesus preaches what we often call the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5 through 7, then we ought to expect that the sermon would be filled with both preaching and teaching. There is both the proclamation of the gospel of the kingdom, that is, good news for citizens of the kingdom of heaven, and there is instruction for how kingdom citizens ought to live. There is both news and advice in the Sermon on the Mount. And so the sermon begins with this section that we call the Beatitudes, and they describe the essential nature of kingdom citizens. And right from the start, with these eight startling statements that Jesus makes, we'll see that they explode with both news and advice. And the news is that against all expectations, against anything that you might predict, that the people like the ones that Jesus describes here are the people who are truly blessed. That's a pronouncement of good news. But the advice is that if you want to be blessed, then you must become like the people Jesus describes. And so these statements are revolutionary. In them, Jesus challenges the established order of the world. And he pronounces blessings on people who you might least expect. And so with that being said, let's just go ahead and read them as they are. Beginning here in Matthew chapter 5. We'll actually begin with verse 1. It says, "Seeing the crowds, he went up on the mountain. And when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, 'Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Now, you will notice that each of these eight statements begins with the word blessed, or as we like to say sometimes, blessed, if you want to sound Shakespearean. But that's where we get the term Beatitudes. That's where that term comes from. The word beatitude comes from the Latin word meaning blessedness. So these are the blessed people, the ones that are filled with blessings. And so that leads us to ask the question then, well, what does it mean to be blessed? If we're saying that these people are blessed, what does that mean? And the word blessed is akin to the word happy, though I think that undersells it just a little bit. It's much deeper than that. Properly, the definition of this word is favored by God. So Jesus is telling us that these are the people who will be favored by God. But still, that sort of begs the question, well, what does that mean? What does it mean to be favored by God? And I want to suggest that maybe a decent synonym for this word is the word fulfilled. That what Jesus is describing is the people who will actually find the fulfillment that everyone craves. You notice the kinds of blessings that he enumerates here in these Beatitudes? They really are the kinds of things that everybody is looking for. In verse 4, it's comfort. Everybody wants comfort. I mean, we have entire industries that are dedicated to your comfort. We have air conditioning and mattresses and, you know, furniture and clothing that is all made for your comfort. Verse 5, the blessing is that these people will inherit the earth. It's property or a place to call home. Everybody wants that. Everybody wants a place to rest their head at night and say, this is my home. This is a place that I can rest and belong. In verse 6, it's satisfaction. Everybody wants to be satisfied. But the problem is, no one actually receives those things in the world system. You see, the world promises these kinds of things. The world promises blessings like this, but it doesn't actually deliver them, at least not in any kind of meaningful or lasting way. Now, there are people who achieve some semblance of these things for some amount of time, but eventually, if their hope is placed in the world system and the world's blessings, then they realize the emptiness of it all. They get to a point where they realize that there is no fulfillment, no true fulfillment in the things of this earth. And even if they were to live their entire life and never realize that or acknowledge it, one day they lose it all. You know, that's the point in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. In Ecclesiastes 2 and verse 20, Solomon reflects there and he says, all go to one place. All are from the dust. I'm sorry, I'm in chapter 3. That makes the point too, though. How about chapter 2 and verse 20? He says, so I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. And so what Jesus is promising is something entirely different than the things that are under the sun. This is an eternal kingdom with eternal blessings. These are people who will be favored by their Creator and thus completely fulfilled in a way that the world could never fulfill them. Now, another thing that I think we should notice as we just look at this section of text as a whole is that we ought to see these blessings as being a composite picture. They are essential descriptions of a single, complete character. You'll notice that the first and the last Beatitudes end with the same kind of blessing. Verse 3 says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And then verse 10, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And so they both promise the same blessing. Verses 11 and 12 are really just an expansion of verse 10. And what that tells me is that we ought to be seeing the Beatitudes as a single unit. You know, Jesus is not describing 8 different groups of people. He's describing a single group of people. It's a lot like the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5. When Paul talks about the fruit of the Spirit, he's not talking about 9 different fruits, but he's talking about one fruit with 9 distinct qualities. And so to perfect one of them is to perfect them all, and to lack one of them is to lack them all. You can't really be somebody who is super good at love, joy, and peace, and at the same time be super bad at patience, kindness, and goodness. It's just not really going to work that way. And in the same way, Jesus is not describing 8 different groups of people, but one group with 8 distinct qualities. This is the good soil in the parable of the sower. Jesus is sowing the seed of the kingdom. And so he begins by describing the people who will be receptive to it. These are the ones who, hearing the word, hold it fast in an honest and good heart and bear fruit with patience. This is the one who hears the word and understands it and bears fruit. And so the Beatitudes describe the essential nature of the people who will respond to the gospel. In Bible class this morning, we were talking about how God predestines people for election or for salvation in Ephesians chapter 1. This is those people. You see, the gospel is designed in such a way that it will attract some people and it will repel others. It's an offensive message that will only reach the hearts of those who are willing to receive it. These are those people. These are the ones who the gospel will attract and bless. And they are the ones who the world would least expect. You know, the world's system rewards the rich, not the poor. It rewards people who laugh, not people who cry. It rewards the proud, self-centered, and aggressive, not the meek, merciful peacemakers. But this kingdom is not an earthly kingdom. Jesus said in John 18, in verse 36, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews, but my kingdom is not from the world." And so this is an upside-down kingdom. The value structure of the kingdom of heaven is totally opposite of the value structure of worldly kingdoms. And Jesus himself is the perfect representation of this radically different kingdom as its humble and glorious king. That was this point in Mark chapter 10. Remember in Mark 10 when 2 of his disciples asked him about being great in the kingdom of heaven. In Mark 10 and verse 42, Jesus called them to him and said to them, "You know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them, but it shall not be so among you. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." And so just as the king is an unexpected king, the citizens of the kingdom are unexpected citizens. The true fulfillment, the true blessings, the true riches go to the people that the world would least expect, because these people don't belong to the world. They're part of something totally different. And so what I'd like to do for the rest of our time is to look at these 8 Beatitudes one by one, very quickly. And so the first is in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 3. The first blessing is for the poor in spirit. "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." If we are going to be citizens of the kingdom of heaven, this is where we must begin. And Jesus is really describing an attitude of shameless humility. That's the idea. Shameless humility. You know, the rich person trusts in himself. The rich person doesn't think that he needs God for anything. That's the problem with physical riches. You know, Jesus often warns about the dangers and the temptations of physical riches, and hopefully we understand that it's not a sin to have wealth. There were righteous people that have had wealth. But that with wealth, there comes very strong temptation. And so, by and large, many people who have wealth are proud, arrogant, wicked people. And what Jesus is describing is that those people who are rich in that way, those are people who are self-reliant, you know? They don't need God for anything. They have comfort. They have satisfaction, or at least they believe they do or think that they do, but they don't feel like they need God for anything. And Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is not for people like that. But then, you know, imagine that somebody else comes to God and says, you know what, I'm doing okay on my own. Like, I'm a decent person. I'm not a terrible person. And I think I have some talents and abilities that I could bring to the kingdom. And so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to come to God and say, I want to serve you. I want to give you my abilities and talents and service. And I'll take what you're offering also. Like, it'll be kind of transactional. That's not spiritual poverty. That's being spiritually middle class. Jesus is describing spiritual beggars. People who come to God with shameless humility, with their hands open, saying, God, I have nothing to offer. I have nothing to bring. There is nothing that I can give you that you need. And they confess that their only hope is in his grace. It's a disposition of the heart where we realize that we are totally reliant on God's grace to have any blessing at all. I'm reminded of the parable of the dishonest manager in Luke chapter 16. In Luke 16, Jesus tells a parable of a dishonest manager who had gotten himself into some trouble, and he says in verse 3, I am not strong enough to dig, and I am too ashamed to beg. You see, none of us are strong enough to dig ourselves out of the pit that we've fallen into. But the poor in spirit are those who lose their sense of shame, those who are not ashamed to beg. The second beatitude is in verse 4. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, just like the first beatitude describes spiritual poverty, the second describes spiritual sorrow. Jesus isn't really talking about the unavoidable mourning that all of us encounter in life. There are seasons where all of us experience grief and sorrow. Things like some sickness or illness or injury or the loss of a loved one. That's not what Jesus has in the focus. Jesus is talking about people who recognize the horrors of sin and are moved to grief, moved to sorrow about them. It's kind of like in 2 Corinthians 7, when Paul is talking about godly grief that produces a repentance that leads to salvation. See, these are the tears that we choose to cry. This is the sorrow that we have because of a spiritual sensitivity in our hearts. And that's something that will separate the citizens of the kingdom of heaven from the citizens of the world. Because the world doesn't only accept sin. The world embraces it. The world revels in it. The world rejoices in it and celebrates it. But citizens of the kingdom of heaven see sin for all of the horror that it brings. They see it for the slavery. They see it for the ugliness. And it moves them to grief that produces repentance. Because they can diagnose the problem, they will seek the cure. Isn't that the way Jesus talked in Mark chapter 2 and verse 17? He said, those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I came not to call the righteous, but sinners. Citizens of the kingdom of heaven are those who see the terrible disease, and they are the ones who will seek the great physician. The third beatitude is, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The definition of meekness is gentleness, or self-restraint, or strength under control. It's a word that is associated with lowliness and kindness and long-suffering and forbearance. But it certainly isn't weakness. You know, Jesus called himself gentle and lowly in heart in Matthew 11, 29. But later, he said that he had 72,000 angels at his command in Matthew 26, 53. You see, meekness is not weakness, but it is the posture of people who in humility count others as more significant than themselves. And Jesus says, these are the people who will inherit the earth. That's absurd. That's absurd. That the world has never worked that way, you know? Like from the beginning of time, from the beginning of civilization, the people who amass for themselves the most wealth and land have been the people who have taken it from others. It's survival of the fittest. That's the way our own country was established. It was through colonial expansion and manifest destiny. Those who have the most might have the most right. And Jesus says, my kingdom isn't like that. My kingdom's not like that. Jesus says, I'm here to show you a better way. And really, this quote comes from Psalm 37. In Psalm 37, we see this language being used in verse 10 and 11. Psalm 37 in verse 10 says, in just a little while, the wicked will be no more. Though you look carefully at his place, he will not be there. But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace. You see, what Jesus is pointing out is that the inheritance of the wicked is fleeting. Though the wicked might have power and prominence for the moment, Jesus says, just wait. Just keep watching. It won't be like that forever. Ultimately, selfishness is self-defeating and destructive. And the people to whom the earth really belongs are the meek. The fourth beatitude says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. This beatitude describes a difference in appetite. The world never finds satisfaction because the world hungers and thirsts for the wrong things. You know, the world says, if you want to be satisfied, if you want to be fulfilled, then seek it for yourself. Find it in materialism or self-indulgence or pleasure. Find it in sex or money or power. Those are the things that will make you fulfilled. And Jesus says, that's a giant scam. It's like drinking salt water. The more you drink, the thirstier you get. I always like to take the opportunity to quote the Avett brothers here. They have a song called Ill With Want, and the line says, the more I have, the more I think I'm almost where I need to be. If only I could get a little more. And that's the way the things of this world work. The more you have, the more you think you're almost where you need to be. If only you could get a little bit more. And Jesus tells us, righteousness satisfies like nothing else does. It's not that only some of us need it. It's not that only some of us would benefit from it, but it is that only some of us recognize it. It's a difference in appetite. Righteousness is what all of us need, but the only ones who will find it are those with an appetite to seek it. The fifth statement says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." You know what will make you a merciful person? It is coming to terms with just how much mercy you need. That's going to change everything about the way that you treat other people. Go over to Luke chapter 7 with me. In Luke chapter 7, we see an example of somebody who understood this. There is a woman who is anointing Jesus with an alabaster flask of ointment. And she's weeping, and she's wiping his feet with her tears and her hair. And Peter is a little bit offended by this whole thing. And so Jesus tells a parable in verse 41. He says, "A certain moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they could not pay, he canceled the debt of both. Now, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered, "The one, I suppose, for whom he canceled the larger debt." And he said to him, "You have judged rightly." You see, people who are harsh or unforgiving are too proud to admit that they themselves are reliant on mercy. That's the way that works. They don't see their mistakes. They don't see their flaws. They have no awareness of their need for others to be merciful to them. And so the golden rule means nothing to people like that. Whatever you wish that others would do to you, do also to them, doesn't move them to mercy because they don't sense their own need for mercy. But the citizens of the kingdom of heaven are deeply aware of their need for mercy. The poor in spirit know that they can't afford for God to be harsh and unmerciful to them. And so the ones who approach God in that way, as spiritual beggars, are both the givers and the receivers of mercy. The sixth statement says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." The literal meaning of the word pure is single. And so it's something that is free of contaminants. You know, if you've got something that is a pure substance, it is a single substance. There's not any contaminants in that substance. And so this is for the single of heart. The blessing is for the fully committed, the fully sincere. Not for people who would try to have one foot in the kingdom and one foot in the world. But these are the people who put their hand to the plow without looking back. And as they dedicate their entire identities to God, these are the people who will begin to see Him reflected in themselves. You know, there are different ways that we could see the blessings of the Beatitudes. Are these blessings for the present, or are they blessings for the future? My answer is yes, they're both. Much like the spiritual blessings that we see in Ephesians 1, we have already received every spiritual blessing, and at the same time, we are looking forward to the inheritance. The kingdom is already, but not yet. And for people who come to God with a pure heart, they will see God even now reflected in themselves. They will see His character become their character. They will put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge after the image of its creator. They will behold the glory of the Lord and be transformed into the same image. And one day, they will stand in His presence and see His face. I really like the way 1 John 3 gives us this picture. 1 John chapter 3 and in verse 2. It says, "Beloved, we are God's children now, and what we will be has not yet appeared. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, because we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure." See that? When will the pure in heart see God? Well, they'll start to see him now, because the transformation has already begun. But one day, when he appears, they will see him as he is. The seventh beatitude says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God." What Jesus tells us next is that the citizens of the kingdom will be the ones who take up the kingdom's mission as their own. Really, the gospel is a message of peace. That's the point in Ephesians 2. Ephesians 2 and verse 17 talks about Jesus, and it says that he came and preached peace to you who are far off, and peace to those who were near. For through him, we both have access in one spirit to the Father. The gospel is a message of peace. Jesus' message was a message of peace. And the Son of God gave his life in order to make peace. And so now we can have peace with God and we can have peace with one another. And if the Son of God gave his life to make peace, it will be the sons of God who give their lives to making peace too. The same mission, the same purpose that Jesus had will become our mission and our purpose. We will be the ones who take the gospel to all the earth, to the ends of the world, making disciples of every nation. And the last statement, the last beatitude, says, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." You know, that seems like a surprising finale. As Jesus has described the character of these people, the nature of this people, you might expect that the world would accept them and embrace them and celebrate them. Because after all, who would persecute humble, meek, merciful peacemakers? Who would do that? Well, the world would. It always has. And it always will. Jesus goes on to say in verses 11 and 12, "Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." What Jesus says is that if you are persecuted, if you are rejected, then you ought to take that as a good sign, because what that means is that you don't belong here. And if I have proof, if I have evidence that I don't belong here, I'm going to take that as an encouraging sign, because I don't want to belong here. I don't want to be a part of this place. I don't want to be a part of this system. I don't want to be a part of the way that the world works. I don't want my inheritance and my hope and my glory to be in the things of this place. And so Jesus says, if the world rejects you, be encouraged by that. It means that you don't belong. No one who has ever really belonged to the kingdom of heaven has been fully embraced by the kingdoms of the earth. And Jesus is saying that as the ultimate prophet. And he knows what the world will do to him. Sometime later, Stephen will say in Acts 7 and verse 52, "Which of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who announced beforehand the coming of the righteous one, whom you have now betrayed and murdered." Just like the world rejected all of God's prophets, the world rejected the ultimate prophet. And Jesus says in John 15 and verse 20, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. But he wants to remind us that we can rejoice and be glad. Because if we have fellowship with Jesus on earth, then we will also have fellowship with Jesus in heaven. And so, like the disciples in Acts 5, we can go on our way rejoicing that we have been counted worthy to suffer for the sake of his name. And so with that, the Beatitudes are concluded. The Sermon on the Mount is underway with these eight concise statements where the king has given a comprehensive description of the citizens of his kingdom. He's given us the metrics for what distinguishes his people from the people of the world. And the Beatitudes are both news and advice. The news is that these are the people who will be blessed. And the advice is that if you want to be blessed, you must become like these people. Now, you might be left to wonder at this point, if these are prerequisites for blessing, you know, if these are the kinds of qualities that we must have in order to come to Jesus and be blessed, does that mean that we have to fix ourselves before we come to Christ? Is that the point? Like, you've got to get yourself all straightened out first, and then you can come to Christ. That kind of sounds like you're saying, I have to save myself. Is that the idea? Not at all. These are the qualities of people who acknowledge that they can't save themselves. These are the qualities of people who realize that they have a problem that they can't fix. And so they come to God asking him to do his powerful work. These are the qualities of people who will put their faith in the Lord to save them. And so the kingdom of heaven is not a kingdom for the deserving. It is a kingdom for the seeking. It's a kingdom for those who come to God with open hands, saying, I need you because I can't do it myself. And if you have such a heart, you have the opportunity this morning to respond to the invitation before you leave. Because these qualities are invitational. The news is that these are the people who will be blessed, but the advice is that if you want to be blessed, you must become a person like this. And if you have such a spirit, such an attitude, a willingness to come to the Lord, to seek him with all your heart, then you can experience every blessing that's in the kingdom, both now and forever. If you need to make your life right with God in some way, and we can help you, we want to invite you to come to the front and let us know while we stand together and sing the song.